Hello and welcome to the Methodist Podcast, published on the 1st of September 2022. As we've been hearing over recent weeks on the podcast, we're facing an economic humanitarian crisis, the like of which Britain hasn't seen in decades. As living costs continue to skyrocket, families are unable to bridge the gap, and despite the additional support from government, millions of people risk being pushed deeper into poverty by forces outside their control. In this week's podcast, we chat with two people who are living in the benefits gap, and we hear how they're planning to cope with the rises in the cost of living. And we talk to a deacon from Gateshead on how her church is planning to provide a warm space for people this winter. Households where people have disabilities are going to see a disproportionate rise in costs, with extra help not going far enough to cover the increase. Many disabled people have needs that make heating and electricity to run equipment necessities to well-being. Mary lives in York and occasionally volunteers at a food bank. She told me what it was like living with a disability on benefits.
I am the epitome of the starving artist. I work as an artist. I'm a wheelchair user. My partner suffers from depression and is a cancer survivor. And my adult son who lives with us is autistic. And we're okay at the minute. We will not be okay for very much longer. I'm diabetic, so I need a special diet. But I don't, because we can't afford it. We have a heavily carb-based diet, because that's how you feel full. The laughable situation of buying the day would be lovely, but we can't afford four portions of food and fresh fruit and vegetables in a week. So our local supermarket is Morrison's, which is, it's not bad. It's a middling little supermarket, I suppose. But a very small pack of green beans, for example, is £1.29. That's one portion, really. So if you're cooking a meal for a family, you can't. So food bank reliance in this area where I live is high.
Given the increases that we're expecting in the cost of living, unless there's more support, what decisions will you have to make? How are you going to cope?
Well, the saying's been there for a while, hasn't it? Heat or eat. But this is going to be really stark. In my house, this a level of disability, and we need to keep warm. If I get cold, I'm really ill and I can't work. So the heating is on, and I just don't know how we're going to do it. And we are, because I'm old, you can see that. I am of the generation of put a jumper on. But I don't know if we're going to be able to afford to heat the whole house. Probably just the one room that you're using. And that's what people are going to have to do. And you know what? I remember that as a child. People shouldn't be making that choice now for their children. And it's not just heating. People are doing the washing. And they can't dry it outside. They need to dry it inside. And if they can't afford the heating on, how do they dry the washing? How do they get the kids clean clothes for going to school tomorrow? These are the sort of, if you like, the invisible things that come from just not being able to heat a house. And petrol is pushing the cost of fuel that way. It's putting prices up and up and up in the supermarkets. Thank God I don't live in the countryside anymore. Because rural poverty is going to be awful. And the choice of foods and things are going to be even harder. I don't know. I just see more and more people. That my inbox is full of people saying, Mary, are you still doing the food bank? Can we have help? Where do we go? Because we have the official food bank, of course, but they're three strikes. You go three times and then they start questioning why you still need to come. And in a sense, it's good because they're looking at, do you need additional help and support? If you're a single mum or families just need this top up now, and it's making them feel guilty about going and asking for it. It's double-sided. We need to normalise food banks to take away the stigma of going. But in a country like ours, why the hell should we normalise a food bank?
There does seem to be a feeling for people to spend money on anything other than necessities is almost wrong.
Oh, God, no. I mean, I used to say, but this is the line I take when I talk to the local council and things, is when your idea of the future is Wednesday, you need that coffee. You need to do something. We all need something nice in life. But when your idea of the future is Wednesday, you've got no hope for anything else. And I've changed that. And I would say when your idea of the future is 6 o'clock, because you just have to get through today. And at that time, I mean, I was giving families a tin of soup, Campbell's soup, and a packet of pasta. And that was a pasta bake. And, you know, and one of the women from the council, she was on the healthy eating kick. And she was saying that all poor people need to do is be educated to have better food. And they need to learn to cook. Trying to get people to understand the difference between a poverty diet and a poor diet. Nobody chooses a poor diet. We all want nice things. Everybody knows you should have a salad once in a week. You should have some fruit. And we all want to do these things for our children. But when you go into the shops, I mean, we've got things like Heron Foods and Farm Foods here, and you can get a bag of burgers for $1.99, and there's 20 burgers in there. I hate to think what they're made of, but you buy it because your kid's getting a hot meal tonight. And this conception that people on benefits are so much better off, it does nip. But the majority of the people that we work with, and that would include myself, we have either still on working tax credits or we have universal credits to top up. The majority of people on universal credits are working. And they're working hard. So I would really like to challenge this misconception, this idea that everybody on benefits are wasters.
Wayne lives on his own in social housing on the South Coast. Following a successful professional career, he suffered from deteriorating mental health and he was split from his family and lost his job. But his problems were made worse by the pandemic.
While I was unwaged, of course, then we had COVID come along. I also am type 1 diabetic, so I had to go into 18 months isolation. At the same time, I was evicted twice out of private rented accommodation under this Section 21, which is state agents use quite freely. It wasn't a nice time for me. It was quite frightening for me. At the same time, I managed then to try and get myself on a housing list, what they call it, on the housing. I was a single young man or older man. There's not much chance of that. You have very little protection as a single young man or woman, I suppose, but less protection for men. And then what happened was I was offered a flat in sheltered housing, because they dropped the age to 55, so I was allowed to go in. So I went in, and I've been there a year now. But when I went in, I slept on the floor, age 62, slept on the floor, and with no fridge, no cooker, nothing, no curtains, nothing, no furniture, anything. And I was really surprised how I could be left like this. But I was appreciative of what I got, so I then, by hook and crook, people lent me furniture, local church, kind people within the local Emmanuel Church actually bought me a fridge and bought me a cooker, which was I appreciated very much, because I worked very closely with the churches over 20 years. And so that's where I am. I'm seeking work. I have to go under what I would call strict DWP rules. As I said, they tend to treat you like criminals rather than human beings, and it's a one size fits all, regardless of your experiences. For example, I've been to the United Nations, I've been to NATO, I've negotiated with countries, I've met presidents, etc. But I've also worked with what I call local ordinary people at the same time. The balance of trying to find work is quite difficult.
The pressures caused by your situation That must have had a detrimental impact on your mental health.
I think what it is, it's not that you isolate yourself or you become extracted from society. I think it's alienation is the word. It's not that you get alienated. Unfortunately, the way we have a financial systems and structures built today, you're automatically, the moment you have a certain amount of income and that goes, everything else unwinds. Everything unwinds. Your standard of living unwinds. You then suddenly start to owe money. Then your bank accounts get stopped and then you get frozen and it goes down this road. And it's never ending. And you fall deeper and deeper into a cycle. And you can try and get out of it, but the hole's too deep, unfortunately, sometimes. So I do feel sometimes, yes, I'm on the fringes of society, not through my own fault. I've gone through the pain and the anguish of feeling on my own and lonely. I've gone through the pain of the divorce. I've gone through the pain of watching my, you know, unable to take my children for a cup of coffee or things like this. I've gone through all that. I'm now at the stage where it doesn't matter anymore. That doesn't matter. That's yesterday. Where I am today, it counts. Because you do work very hard to try and get yourself back into society where you were, but it seems that society won't let you get back in, no matter how hard you try. And you can bend over backwards. You know, I do probably more voluntary work than most people, you know, but I don't get paid for it. But I do it to keep myself going, to keep myself connected to society, so to speak. But I think we all suffer from psychological isolation. And I think in this country, particularly in this country, we suffer a battle of invisibility, lack of resources when you're in poverty. You suffer, I would say, lack of dignity, because you hear all the myths coming out, scroungers, all they do is drink, buy cigarettes, put TV on, go out and sell drugs. And so that's why I say where poverty is a battle of invisibility. It does affect you physically, spiritually, and mentally in some degrees. So that's where I'm, my mental health, I keep fit. I go for walks. I go to the countryside. I dread being a young person in the city of London or somewhere like that. I'm lucky enough I've got the countryside. I can go for a long walk or I can go to the beach or something like that. But besides that, everything else is a struggle. For example, today I was very buoyant. And I had two bills come in, and I've paid them, but I had two bills, one from British Gas, as saying, if you do not pay your bill, we'll send you to a debt collector. We'll take debt collectors. And I suddenly thought, hang on a minute, I paid my bill yesterday, and now you're sending in a letter today. But also, are you aware that you've made billions and that I'm unemployed? The balancing is completely wrong, you see.
We have inflation affecting everything, such as food and clothes, but the forecast inflation for the cost of fuel is particularly eye-watering. How are you going to cope?
I care, but I don't care, because there's nothing I can physically do anymore. I can just try and give them payments of £1 here, £2 here, £3, £4,000. There's no way that I'm going to survive that. And I'm type 1 diabetic and I have to keep warm. I have a fridge where I keep my insulins. If they turn my electric off, my insulin won't help me. If I don't have any food and can't keep my carbohydrates up and whatever, one day they'll find me unconscious or dead on the floor.
How do you make decisions on how you're going to spend the little money that you do have?
I don't have any decision making. The energy companies make the decision for me and the bills come in. How I make decisions, for example, I have here my budget. Okay? It's all written down. It says EDF, £100. I get Job Seekers Allowance. Job Seekers Allowance is less than Universal Credit. The reason I'm on Job Seeker Allowance and haven't transferred over, and I will be forced to transfer over, is because you will be put into debt again. Because then if you transfer over, you will then have to wait 5 weeks to get this loan. And they give you a loan. Oh, no, before you get, they give you a loan first so you can borrow the money to cover you over 5 weeks while we do the processes and checks and balances to get you passported over to Universal Credit. And this word passporting, things like this, even though they have all my data, all they've got to do is just transfer it over. Why does it take 5 weeks? I don't know. So for me, they would then put me in debt by whatever it cost, whatever the costs they come up with. So I refuse that because I've been in so much debt, it's unbelievable. I've had to go bankrupt. You know, that's the point of it. My end of line was advice from CAB, go bankrupt. And it was them that helped me go bankrupt. So I, after 62 years of life on earth, everything I've worked for, I have nothing left. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I've got a few trinkets, a few things for my children for when I pass away that I can pass on to them, but that's it.
Tracy Hume is a deacon in Gateshead, whose church is working with her local council as part of the Warm Spaces project.
So each Warm Space will be slightly different. What we've done, they asked us particularly to link with faith communities because our buildings are in great places. Usually there might be sometimes a millstone around our neck, but sometimes they are actually a resource that we can make something of. And so we are building on some of the things that churches are already doing. So some places already got luncheon clubs going or a coffee morning drop in. Or, you know, variety of things or of doing food banks, that kind of thing. And it was how might we build some capacity within that to allow people to come and find a free hot drink or two or three for a couple of hours, somewhere they can charge their mobile phone, potentially somewhere to have a conversation if they're lonely, if they just need to offload a little bit. Where the council might be able to provide some expertise, so potentially putting in some people with expertise around how to save energy or Citizens Advice Bureau, that kind of thing. But predominantly, it's quite simple. It is just a warm space where people can come and be safe and warm and find some company.
One of the issues here is the cost of electricity and of fuel. And obviously, your church is going to need heating to keep people warm. And that's going to be expensive. How are you planning on covering the costs of that?
So within Gateshead, the way that Gateshead Council are doing it is that the money that they have been given, every council in the country has been given something called the Household Support Fund, and they can use that as they wish for during this time. Gateshead Council decided to earmark a third of their pot for warm spaces. And basically they've said that any community space that wants to be a community warm space can apply for a grant of up to £500, and that has to be spent initially by the end of September. And then they're hoping that, well, they've been told in the spring statement there'll be more money coming in October, that they could then apply again. And that can be used to either to put some energy efficiency things in place in your building so that you can make a better use of your own energy bills. You can pay towards the utility bill to enable that church to open up a little bit longer, but it not cost any more, or to buy refreshments so that they can be provided for free, or the hot food, that kind of thing. So it can be used in a variety of ways that enables each space to use that best for their circumstances. But you're right, it could, you know, we don't want people thinking, right, well, we can't do that because we can't afford it. There hopefully will be ways through. And if your council don't already run a warm spaces place, then ask how they're using their household support fund and could you access it to be able to provide a warm space.
So how does the scheme work? How long are you going to be open for each week, and what happens when you're closed?
So there'll be a warm spaces directory for Gateshead particularly, and each of the 52 warm spaces, which is an incredible number of people that have applied to do this, the 52 places, will there be like a timetable so people will know which warm spaces are open on what days and for how long. So for most of our churches that are engaged with it, they'll be open maybe for 2 hours once a week. And people can drop in from anywhere that, you know, they can come and go to that. And some people we anticipate will go to one place on a Monday, they'll find another one for a Tuesday or Wednesday. If it means that maybe at midday or mid-morning or at tea time, they don't need to put their heating on or cook a meal or put their kettle on just for a couple of hours. So it's going to be different times and spaces across the whole of the borough. And our churches are looking to sort of make sure that they space that out as well across Gateshead.
You must talk to people there in Gateshead. Many of them are going to be struggling already. How are they feeling about their future?
It's just huge fear, absolute fear. Some people are burying their head in the sand, if we're honest, because they don't want to face it. They can't think about it. Today is enough of a worry. I can't worry about tomorrow as well, even though I know it's coming. But the majority of people are just scared witless. How am I going to do this? They're already making difficult choices. As we know, since the beginning of the year, prices have just gradually been going up and up and up. So people have already tightened their belt, as they say, and now they're thinking, I don't know what else I can do. And whereas before we were hearing about people making choices between whether they heat or eat, some people are not even going to have those choices available to them. They can't do either. And so it's a real fear of and for our churches and for community people working with them, we're fearing that we don't know how to support people through this anymore, that this has got to an unprecedented level of need that we've never experienced before, and we can't solve everybody's problems. So there's that fear of I can't do everything I would like to be able to do to help you. So there is those real fears going on, and there is real fear about mental health and physical health decline. We know that when people are cold, when they're stressed, that their physical health and their mental health declines. And we know that services have been cut to the bone as well for those support. So there's fear about what that's going to do for those, and for fear of isolation. I'm already fairly isolated after COVID, you know, struggling to get back into things. And now I could be isolated because I can't afford to travel, whatever that looks like.
If a church wants to start its own Warm Spaces project, how do they go about it?
So there's a couple of things I think are really important. The first is you can either build on or initiate a conversation that you already might have with your local councillors or your local MPs to find out how your council are using their household support fund and how you might be able to tap into that. You can say, look, we've got a building, we've got some time and some people, we would like to look at doing this. How can you help us to manage to do that? So that's the first thing. Another thing is to ensure that we don't just assume what people need. So as I said, with Gateshead, they've got a Warm Spaces charter, which they're more than happy for other people to use and access. We can provide a link for that so that we ensure that people find it a safe space in all those, the terms, you know, understanding of that term. But also that people understand that this is a difficult thing for people to access. And so let's make sure that we find out what it is they need, what time of day will work best. Let's not make assumptions about, well, this suits us, but actually the people who need it, that doesn't work for them. So maybe trying to facilitate a few conversations with maybe people who've been coming through your doors for some of your activities or been to the food bank or people in the community you know who may access these things, have that conversation. Listen to those voices, not just make assumptions about, well, this is what we're going to provide and that's it.
Thank you for listening to this week's Methodist podcast. If you'd like to read the report, Is the Cost of Living Support Enough?, that was produced alongside the Joint Public Issues Team, you can find it on the Methodist Church website. From myself, Mike Ivatt, goodbye.